This is what I've been waiting for, and I hope our telephone connection holds up. I understand it's been a little problematic, but Robert Collins was career Air Force, serving in the fields of avionics, ground communications, engineering, physics, and intelligence, foreign technology division at Wright-Patt, gaining an in-depth understanding of all the career fields. After 22 years, he left public service to pursue the subject of UFOs full-time, living on an Air Force retirement supplemented by odd jobs. In his many adventures within the Air Force, he was tuned into the world of UFOs by Ernie Kellerstrass, I believe it is, in 1985. Ernie was a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel who worked at the FTD, that would be Foreign Technology Division, until retiring. After performing some research, he concluded that the government UFO cover-up was real and went to great lengths to uncover the cover-up, which spanned over 60 years. So, in a moment, Robert Collins. First time on the air on Coast to Coast AM, Robert Collins, welcome.
How you doing, Art?
I'm doing very well indeed. Great to have you on the program, and I've been looking forward to this because I've heard so much about...
I hope it's not rumors and propaganda.
...about Wright-Patt, and you seem to know quite a bit. What Robert, got you involved in ufology, period?
What am I involved? Just about everything, anything and everything from Area 51 to Los Alamos to...
No. Not what you're involved in, but what got you involved. There's got to be a trigger event, something that got you started.
Well, let's see here. Okay, now I know where you're coming from. It started back in, 1985, when I was sitting there as an analyst in the Foreign Technology Division in the field of theoretical physics and just chatting away with people there. And all of a sudden, the subject of UFOs came up. And one of those people in the office said, well, there's somebody you want to talk to. And so he gave me the name of one Ernie Kellerstrass. And, of course, by that time, Ernie was retired. And I called Ernie, and he gave me one walloping story, which I'll never forget to this day.
But the initial conversation, I mean, did you initiate it? Did you sit across the table from somebody and say, you know, what do you know about UFOs?
For some reason, when you're in a vault there, all the kinds of information fly around within the vault, and the subject of UFOs just came up. I don't know whether I brought it up or somebody else did, and then
right. And
they said, well, there's, as I say, there's somebody you should talk to. And so there I got a hold of Ernie, and then he gave me some incredible stories, which I promptly wanted to check out with everybody else and verified that this guy was not a nutcase.
Can you do it quickly? I mean, can you give us an overview of what Ernie told you that set you on fire?
One incident was the F-106 incident at Misawa, Japan, back in 1959, where they had some specially modified 106s, specially equipped with new types of air-to-air radar, and they sent one of these things up to intercept a UFO that would normally come over. Normally the pattern would be they normally come over the base and sit there and hover. So on this particular day, they sent up one of these 106s to intercept it, and the pilot got within firing range, and he asked ground control if he had permission to fire, and ground control told him, well, let's call it. We'll call the Pentagon, and let's see if we can get the okay for you to do that. So the short story is that he got the okay, and he fired his salvo of missiles at this UFO, and they all detonated, but the UFO was still there.
Yikes.
The pilot by that time was in a full panic. And he told ground control, it's still in the air. The missiles didn't have any effect on it. And by that time, according to the story, the tractor beam came out of the UFO and latched on the 106. And the ground controllers could hear the pilots screaming and yelling as this thing was being pulled into the UFO.
My God.
And the other little incident...
Let's stick with that one for just a moment. If you were to fire a salvo of missiles, whatever he had at the time, into a UFO, was it a disc typical disc
It's a
shape?
typical, you're right, typical oval-looking shape, disc-shaped kind of object, right? And these things used to, back in the 50s, especially around Misawa, I understand that they used to just sit there and come in and just sit for hours and hours and just hover above the base.
My God. You know, that's kind of like taking a high-powered pistol and pumping six shots into somebody in front of you and having them smile at you.
Yeah.
You go, oh, uh-oh.
Sure.
I mean, Robert, if you know, was the authorizing rationale to fire at something like this in the first place? Many of us have wondered about this. I mean, presumably something oval-shaped, defying gravity, having come light years to get here, probably wouldn't be something you want to shoot at, mostly.
Well, I don't know the mentality of the people who made that decision. I don't know how much they knew about what the Air Force knew starting from 1947 up to that period in 1959.
Right.
I don't know who the bureaucrats were in the Pentagon that said, yeah, go ahead and try it. Maybe they just want to see how their new weapon systems worked, would affect these UFOs.
Remember, UFOs are not a threat to national security.
Right. We know that. Right?
So there was another incident, and then you tried to confirm these, and I'll be very interested in what you did. So what is the other one?
Well, according to what he said, there is a compound on Sandia Base that back in the early 60s that was used to do chemical testing on animals. And it's right across the street from where Loveless is today. If you go down to Sandia Base, if you get on the base, on the south end of the base, there's this called the Loveless Institute, and they do testing on animals. You can hear the dogs barking in the back of the compound, so they test on dogs too. But back in '64, they were doing testing on horses and monkeys, and other exotic or different type. I don't remember all the different types of animals, but Ernie and his friend Bob was in this compound, and according to what he told me, they were doing chemical testing on alien body parts, radiation testing.
My God!
And those two stories, and then of course there's
what radiation testing?
Yeah, radiation to see how the body parts respond to radiation.
All right, so these were live apparent aliens or dead?
These were very dead aliens.
Very dead.
They were. I guess one of the doctors, I think, told Ernie they were. These bodies were on loan, or the body parts were on loan from Wright-Patterson at the time. And the doctor told Ernie the rest of what they had was up at Wright-Patt.
Holy smokes! All right, you're right. I mean, if somebody told you with a straight face these two stories, I can see how that would light a fire, get you going, try to confirm the stories. After all, if true, this is the world's biggest story, isn't it?
Oh, it's been a big story for a long time, but it seems to get buried in the wars of Iraq or something.
Well, yeah. So all right, you heard this, you set out to try and confirm the stories. What did you do?
Well, it was a succession of steps. First, I had a call, a lot of people, and who knew Ernie, and verified that this guy was really who he said he was. And they said, yes, we've heard the same stories, and we know who he is, we know his background, and we don't doubt what he's saying to us, that it might be true. Then I proceeded to call Bill Moore. And
of course, Bill Moore.
Right, and Bill Moore took a very big interest in this, in Ernie. And so he called Ernie, I believe, and I don't know what he talked to.
Would you do me a favor and repeat Ernie's last name again?
Kellerstrass.
Kellerstrass. Okay. What position was he in? What was Ernie? How did he know all these things?
Well, that's another story in itself. He is a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. He's worked at AFLOTEC. His primary mission was in intelligence. He did a lot of intelligence work, but he tells me that he never had any direct access to any of this material. It's what somebody else told him, except for the two direct incidences that we talked about.
Okay, in these two, though, in 1959 and I believe 1964,
right,
he has direct...
Were the two that he said he was directly involved
direct
in. But
knowledge,
he said he doesn't know anything above that beyond what he was told. However, there was a Paul McGovern who knows Ernie, who's a good friend of Ernie's, who said Ernie was out at Area 51.
Is Ernie still with us?
Oh, yes. Well, and he still works here in Dayton, Ohio.
In Dayton, Ohio. All right.
Right.
Do you correspond with him frequently?
I haven't talked to him in a couple years. These sources are very strange people, and they will tend to tell you a lot of things, and then they'll just sit there and pull back on you.
Uh-huh. So that would imply that you've gone to Ernie at another point and he denied it or denied ever saying it or what?
He said he was having too many family problems and he just didn't want to, get into any more conversations about it.
Understandable, Robert. A number of people that I've interviewed over the years, including John Lear, has had a number of periods in his career when he just said, look, I'm washing my hands of this. I've had it. I'm not going to talk about this stuff anymore. It is affecting my family, my career. I just can't do it anymore. That kind of deal.
Sure, sure, right.
So, anyway, you have independently confirmed in these two incidences and maybe more what Ernie told you.
I'm trying to quantify that. The only thing we can confirm is that the fact that they had the 106s at the time. That's the only thing that we can confirm. We can't confirm the incident because the Air Force denies it. You can't confirm the incident on the south area of Sandia Base back in 1964 because, then again, that gets denied. The only things we can confirm are what sources tell us is what's the makeup of Wright-Patterson and the tunnels and the vaults.
Well, we'll get to that. On the F-106, you would think that it would be possible to confirm the loss of a pilot, whether it would be listed as an accident or some other way.
In that case, it would just be listed as an accident, lost at sea or something, and presumed dead.
Right. Okay. So you were in contact then with Bill Moore and Jamie?
Bill Moore, I met in the spring of 1986 in a motel room in Los Angeles. Was on TDY to TRW at the time there.
Right.
And he showed me a copy of, before it was ever in the public domain, of the Eisenhower briefing document, that 35-millimeter film.
Sure.
The famous one.
Oh, yes.
And he just showed it to me, and he said, do you know anything about this? And I just looked at the document, and I said, this is news to me. And... he said he couldn't let me have copies of it, and so that's how everything got started. And I went back to Dayton, Ohio, and he went back to wherever he was doing, and then the phone calls, and we're talking about thousands and thousands of hours of phone calls, and then we had the meetings all the way from starting in the fall of 1986, and that's when I met Jamie at Ernie's house. Ernie Kellerstrass house, and we had Hal Putoff and John Alexander and a number of other people there, and we had a big powwow about this, and Ernie then explained everything he knew about the subject to us in the living room.
And can you relate?
That's what got all the ball rolling on everything.
Yeah, can you relate some of that? Can you remember the high points?
Well, he went into details about Area 51 and the guards disappearing in Area 51. All they could find was the vehicle, and we talked a little bit about mentioned the Red Book, and then we talked about the Yellow Book. And the fact is that the aliens believe in one God, and that the Red Book is a compilation of all the ongoing government research since 1947.
Let me slow you down again. The Red Book, you said, and the aliens believe in one God.
Are you familiar with the Majestic website?
I am.
Okay. If you go to the Majestic website, there's something called the First Annual Report. You ever seen it?
I believe I have. Yes.
Okay. Well, the Red Book is a those annual reports were put out every year starting in around 1952. And so the 52, 53, 54, they took all those annual reports and put them together into one volume called the Red Book.
Okay.
So each year, the Red Book gets updated with a new annual report.
All right. Let's go to direct knowledge that you have. You were at Wright Pat. You know something about, and I've really always been curious about these underground vaults, these hangars, all these underground things that are said to be under Wright Patterson, and what's hidden there. How much do you actually know about that, Robert?
Well, let me try to put it this way. We have enough information that if we had an interested party like Congress willing to investigate that, we could prove that those things are there in a matter of days.
How would you do that?
All we'd have to do is knock down some concrete walls.
Knock down some concrete walls in a heavily protected...
It would take civil engineering a couple of days to knock down those walls to prove that those tunnels and those vaults are there.
How do you know they're there?
Oh, because they've been seen on radar. I don't work by myself. I work with a group of people. And I have a lot of people in important places, like at Wright Pat, who have access to things. And they tell me certain things. And also, too, I've got thousands and thousands of drawings taken from Wright Pat that are official. In fact, the guy who gave them to me had a security clearance pulled.
Really?
Yes, he lost his security clearance over it. And these drawings, plus what's been seen on radar imaging, which I didn't get to see, but my friend did, who works there.
You have these drawings now, Robert?
They're on the machine here. And they're also in the book. You've got a lot of the drawings are in that book you have. I don't know if you have a copy of it.
No, I do not in front of me.
Okay. I sent one to Lisa, I believe. Lisa has a copy.
Right. It just didn't make it to me in time. That's all right. We're on radio anyway, so what we've got to try to do is describe, you know, if somebody lost their security clearance over this, and you've got it in a book, then it's public knowledge, right?
At
this point.
We've got enough. If we were given permission, we could prove the case there in a couple of days. That's how confident we are.
Well, you and I both know that is not going to happen.
No, the Air Force is not going to allow you to bust down their walls.
Nope. So how much is below Wright Pat? I mean, physically, how much is down there?
Physically, there are about, if I'm trying to count these right, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 vaults.
5 what you call vaults.
Well, anywhere from the size of 100 by 100 feet, which is 1,000 square feet, all the way up to, or I should say all the way down to some little small vault area, which is down by the what we call the used to be the medical center, or the biological medical study center, which is down the hill from where the main vaults are at. And that's where I understand that's where they brought up. They used to roll. These tunnels are you could drive a pickup truck through.
And they probably do.
Yeah, they're big tunnels, and you could drive a Ford pickup truck through them.
And how much do we know about what's stored in these vaults?
Well, there's nothing stored there anymore. All this was, they move faster. They keep track of the public attitudes and public ideas and what the public might know about this stuff. And as soon as they think they're in trouble, they take all the stuff and they move it. So all this stuff was moved out of Wright Pat in 82 and 83.
To where?
Primarily to Los Alamos and to Area 51.
Okay, well, there are others who say that there was a great deal at Area 51 and that it was moved out of there.
I can't verify any of that. I can't verify those kind of stories. And Rick Doty, I talked to Rick, and I've got other sources, and I can't verify any of those stories.
So your best intel at the moment would be that a lot of this is still at Area 51?
Right. Yeah, they're making some big major money investments in Area 51, so I really doubt that anything's been moved.
Well, you're right about that. They're expanding Area 51. All right, Robert, hold tight. Robert Collins is my guest. He says a lot of what was at Wright Pat was moved to Area 51 and elsewhere. And to the best of his knowledge, it's still there. And that would have been my bet, because indeed they're expanding Area 51. You can't get as close as you used to. I'm Art Bell. Robert Collins is my guest. He says he knows a lot about what was apparently at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, part of what still may be there, the underground areas that were associated with the storage of you-know-what. We'll get back to him in a moment. Well, all right, Robert Collins has a website, www.ufoconspiracy.com, good domain name, and his book is Exempt from Disclosure. Robert, why exempt from disclosure?
Well, it's a typical label they put on documents they don't want to downgrade. So they'll put at the bottom either exempt from exempt. Well, actually, it'll say exempt from downgrade.
Meaning downgrade in security level.
Yeah, security level, right? Exempt from downgrade. Right. It'll say that down the lower right corner, I believe. It's been a while since I looked at some of those documents. So that the in a sense, what it's saying, it's exempt from disclosure.
Okay. All right. This person, how did it come about that you got these diagrams of what is below Wright Pat?
Well, it goes back to the civil, what I call my civil engineering person, without mentioning names.
Right.
He and I started working together about 1993. It was over a 10-year effort on our parts. And then we took information from the sources, like Ernie provided a lot of information, and Rick Doty provided a lot of information. And we took their information plus what we got out of the drawings, and we were able to fit all that source information with what was in the drawings.
Right.
And so we could match up with what they're saying with what we found. And
was he still active duty?
We had to go through thousands and thousands, I mean literally thousands and thousands of Wright Pad drawings.
Uh-huh. Was he still active duty when he handed you these?
Oh, he's civil service.
Civil service, but
right.
Still employed.
Right. Yeah, he had a huge interest in it and finding out whether those bolts were really there or not. And so he did a lot of his own investigation, and plus we were working together, and he gave me a lot of those drawings, which I ran copies of them, scanned them in, and then destroyed the original copies so he wouldn't get in trouble.
But he did get in trouble. He got his clearance yanked, right?
Yeah, he in 1998 he got his clearance pulled.
As a direct result of what he gave you?
Right. As soon as the let me back up on that. As of 1996 he had his clearance pulled.
Okay.
It's because of when I first posted a preliminary report on the vaults at Wright-Patterson, the Air Force just went ballistic.
Were you contacted?
No, but they had my phones tapped.
Nobody
has physically ever come to see me.
Okay, how do you know your phones were tapped? A good tap is not detectable.
My good friends like Rick Doty. Uh-huh. Have the abilities and the equipment to test phone lines that can detect rust 2,000 miles away.
Okay. So you believe your phones were tapped, or they confirmed it for you.
Right.
And you did say you had thousands of hours of conversations on phone, right?
Right. Well, with all the people I mentioned to you before, right, we had nonstop, Jamie, Bill, we had Kit Green, Hal Putoff. Of course, John Alexander was out there somewhere, unless he was never really that involved in it. And plus the people I just talked to you, my
I know John Alexander very well.
Yeah, that's why my Red Pack person. And then we had not only thousands of hours of conversations, but we had these regular meetings up to about 1991, I believe.
Huh. Okay. What Air Force office does counter-intel work?
That would be Rick's old office, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, PJ. We call them the pajama gang, affectionately.
Uh-huh.
And they're the ones that run all the counterintelligence. They protect all the black programs for the Air Force. They have an office right here at Wright-Patterson. They have an office there in the Pentagon, and I think they might have an office at Kirtland, or they may maybe they used to, but I don't know if they still do.
Where are you actually located right now?
I'm in Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton, Ohio. Oh, so you're close.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Yeah.
Close to Nevada.
Do you think your phones are still tapped?
As of 2003, there were still phone taps on this phone line as of 2003. So we just assume they're phone taps on.
Mm-hmm. All right. When they yanked his clearance, they must have, pulled him in, and he had to stand in front of somebody, and something happened, right?
Yes, but I didn't get those details. I know when I posted that preliminary Wright-Patt report back in 96, they sent him to Florida on a vacation for 2 weeks.
Uh-huh. Okay. What...
He doesn't tell me everything, but I learn enough things that you can get a good picture of what's going on.
Uh-huh. The Aeronautical Systems Center, AFC, at Wright-Patt does what? They oversee, as you mentioned, the black programs, right?
Well, you've heard of Aurora, haven't you?
Of course.
Well, they manage the Aurora program out at Area 51.
Okay.
They manage the F-117 and the B-2 when it was hush-hush and in a black program.
All those now are pretty well known.
Right.
One can only imagine, or perhaps you can tell us, Robert, what came after Aurora, what came after the B-2. In other words, those were the secret projects being managed. What are they managing now?
I don't know if they have anything after the B-2. I don't know if they have anything after the 117. We suspect, but we can't really prove at this point that that they manage UFO programs.
You know anything about black triangles?
Yes. Uh-huh. No. No. Some people say they're ours, but I don't believe that.
Okay. Where exactly at Los Alamos are the UFO artifacts?
Well, TA 49 is was the original facility. That was called the Dulce Complex in 1954. They converted an underground nuclear storage facility into what has now become the Dulce Complex.
Right.
And then there's a few other locations, but we don't know a whole lot about them. One of them is TA. I can't remember that one. Was TA 40? But yeah, it was TA 40. TA 40 is now the alternate entryway into TA 49. Because in TA 49, they closed up that entryway back in around 2001 because of all the security leaks.
What was there that you know of?
You mean in TA 49?
Yes.
I have never been in that facility, but Rick has, and I understand.
What does Rick say?
Well, it's pretty huge. They always use front organizations to hide. What they're really trying to do in some places, and that's normally designated as a munitions testing area. But then in a certain building you walk into, and you'd go to a certain elevator, and this elevator was behind a vault door, and they'd have to open the vault door up before you could go in the elevator. And this elevator would get down about five stories or so, and then it would open up on the bottom. And he said the underground facility there, which we call the Dulce Complex, was pretty extensive.
And what did he see?
He said he just saw, went into a room and escorted into a room and sat down in the back with a friend, and a lieutenant colonel or a Fulbert colonel, I'm sorry, a Fulbert colonel walked up to him. And had him sign a special security clearance for the EB-2 interview.
For the EB-2 interview.
Right, which which is in the book.
Extraterrestrial biological entity, right?
Right.
Continue.
So, as it's described in the book,
describe it here.
I'm trying to remember all the details about 4 foot. Was it 4'3"? Alien walked in a tight-fitting jumpsuit, and there were three civilians there at the front table. I think there was a colonel. I think there was a colonel and two civilians out there sitting right there at the interview table, and he wasn't sure whether this EBE was either talking verbally or telepathically. He couldn't tell where the sound was coming from, but he could hear it, but he couldn't see the mouth of the EBE moving.
Okay, you believe him?
I do, because everything else he's told me, it checks out. Right Pat sure checked out.
Well, when you say Right Pat checked out, what exactly do you mean? Do you mean that the documents that you got this guy's clearance pulled checked out, or
the documents show you where walls were put up, where stairwells were at, where elevators were at, where tunnel entries were at, where surveillance cameras were at, and then there's nothing there.
I mean, all of this could be true, Robert, but it could be for a national security purpose that either did or didn't have anything to do with ETs or ET artifacts or whatever.
Well, they certainly pulled this guy's clearance for some reason, I guess.
Well, anytime you disclose something that's national security, trust me, your security clearance is going to vaporize.
Well, we must have hit something, but...
I'm sure you did.
It certainly was pretty extensive, and the way this thing was blocked, and these entryways were blocked and concreted up, and walls were put up, and that the people there would never know there was anything there. People today there work at Right Pat have no idea where any of this stuff would be.
Well, apparently... this stuff is no longer there. Are you fairly sure of that, that it's all been cleared out?
You can never be 100% clear, certain of anything, but we're pretty certain that all the hardware and was moved out. There might be some documentation, which still is kept at NASIC, which used to be FTD, but we don't know that. We can't prove those kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Do you have first-hand knowledge of any of the things that we've talked about so far tonight? Because most of what you've told me has been, you know, so-and-so told me, so-and-so told me.
I've seen UFOs a number of times.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, I mean, with respect to what you've told us about Dulce, about Right Pat, and we sort of briefly touched on Area 51, we'll talk about S4.
Well, but I'm not so much of a person who goes out who has seen things. What I do is collect information and put it together. We call it intelligence in the Air Force.
Sure.
And so I take all the source information, plus the things I learn on my own, and put it together, try to check it, which we've done, be able to do with other sources, with other facilities, and with other people. And put it together and put out a report.
And so the conclusions you've come to are that they had these underground facilities that you've documented. You've got the drawings of them at Right Pat. They had, you believe, artifacts there, possibly bodies there. They were moved, you believe, to Dulce or Area 51. Is that correct?
That's correct, as far as we know.
How much do you know now... Robert, I'm right out here. You may be near Right Pat, but I'm just around the corner from Area 51, just over the mountain from me here. And I'd be very interested in how much you know about Area 51, how compartmentalized the whole thing is.
All I know about Area 51 is what the sources report, what's in the book, what Kit Green has told me. Kit Green said he was out there, but he never saw any UFOs. Gene Lakes was the chief of security there up to 1996, and he knows Kit Green. Kid didn't have the access to go to the places that this stuff was kept. And even if you work at Area 51, you're extremely compartmentalized. They wear color-coded badges, and they're separated by containment areas. So unless you have the access, you won't see anything that's out of the unusual.
Mm-hmm. Then how do you know anything out of the unusual is there?
Other than what the what's on the people have videotaped, these objects around Area 51, or what the sources have said, that's as much as I know.
And S4?
And S4 is the same way. The sources have said they've been there, described it, said this is what's there, and said Lazar, some of what Lazar is saying is true.
Have you spoken to Bob Lazar?
No, but friends of mine have. I haven't spoken to him. Rick Dilley's the drawings in the book of the S4 facility, which are in the book, Rick Doty says that's exactly the way it's laid out.
Mm-hmm. All right. You claim to know, apparently from one of the questions here, how the anti-gravity systems work on reverse-engineered UFOs, which you believe, I guess, were flying, right?
Again, back to what the sources say, they've been flying these since what, the early 60s. And according to what the sources say, they've crashed a lot in the Gulf of Mexico. The Cash Landrum case was an example of that, where in that case, that object over Texas got in trouble and is surrounded by helicopters. And of course,
Barney Hill.
Yeah, got severely burned by the radiation from that thing. That was supposedly one of our reverse-engineered our objects or craft.
Okay, so you actually know, though, how the anti-gravity systems work?
Well, of course, this goes back to the latest in what's going on in the world of physics, and then what the sources are telling me, and I compare what the sources are telling me with what's going on in physics. And right now, they're saying that superconducting capacitors are superconducting currents.
Right.
And the superconducting currents are used for deep space, and superconducting capacitor configurations are used for the atmospheres of planets.
Okay. To maneuver in atmosphere.
They have to reconfigure the anti-gravity field to maneuver in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Even though the alien energy device, ED, whatever that is way beyond our ability to understand, can you explain its basic operation?
The device of what contains what? So around 6,366 small black circular objects. Well, they want 0.003 centimeters and spinning counterclockwise. Within a circular sphere, and this sphere supposedly has liquid in it. And when they put a demand of electricity on this device, they get an output. And this liquid, they decided this liquid that collects around these little circular black devices is an isotope of hydrogen called H5. And this H5 it acts as a catalyst to extract energy out of the vacuum. I'm doing a lot of work at Los Alamos, from what I understand, to try to get produce H5 and then find ways to stabilize it. Because it's very unstable. And they do have some patented devices. Some of those are in the book, which... I'm not sure how much success they've had with them.
All right. Robert, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. We've got to take a break. I wonder if H5 has anything to do with element 115 or if they're related. I'm Art Bell. We'll be right back.